Today on Off Mic, the future for a historic high school in Northwest Indiana looks bleak. We talked to a member of the Indiana State Board of Education about it. With Iowa and New Hampshire in the bag, it's on to Nevada and South Carolina for the Democratic candidates for president. We talk about how local supporters for Bernie Sanders, Amy Klobuchar, and the rest are gearing up for those primaries, as well as Super Tuesday. It's Valentine's Day, so we make a stop at a local florist on this Super Bowl for those in the flower business. It's All-Star Weekend in Chicago. We get an update on all the festivities. All this on Off Mic. First, the news. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Yesterday, a board called the Distress Unit Appeals Board in Indiana, clunky name, it's also known as the DUAB Board, it voted 5-0 to not fix up Roosevelt High School in Gary, Indiana. They say it's too expensive to fix. That means the historic school will likely close for good. Roosevelt had been under state control due to poor performance, but last month, the Indiana State Board of Education voted to return the school back to Gary control. Joining me to talk about the decision is Tony Walker, a member of the Indiana State Board of Education. Hello, Mr. Walker. Welcome to Off Mic.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Mr. Walker, you represent Gary on the State Board of Education. This latest decision by the DUAB Board not to invest millions to fix up Gary Roosevelt, what's your take on that?
Well, at the end of the day, the Gary Community School Corporation does not have enough students in high school to operate two high schools at two separate facilities. And on top of that, there's been a steady decline in the enrollment at Roosevelt. So it really comes down to Gary Community School Corporation not being able to operate two high schools in two separate dilapidated buildings.
Yeah, and tell me, though, as somebody who is from Northwest Indiana, from a strictly historical standpoint, we know when Gary Roosevelt opened, it was to serve a growing African-American population in Gary during segregation times in Gary. Just from that angle, it's still got to be somewhat emotional to see this school possibly close for good.
Oh, absolutely. And my grandfather graduated from Gary Roosevelt. My mother graduated from Gary Roosevelt. I would say it probably hit its pinnacle in the late 1950s. I mean, during a period of time where you had a lot of African Americans getting graduate degrees and terminal degrees like PhDs, they couldn't find work other places. So in a lot of cities across the country, you had a lot of black PhDs actually teaching in high school. And Gary Roosevelt was one of those schools where in the 1950s you had several faculty members there that actually had PhDs. And during that time period, I mean, there was a gallery, a real state-of-the-art art gallery at the top of the school there. And so it was more than just a school at one point. It was the heart of the community, and it had an attention to education, and not just academic education, but the whole development of the child. And that's why folks have been so attached over so many years to Gary Roosevelt, because it was more than just a school. It was a place that incubated leaders and actually set people on their path for future careers. You have so many people now, particularly as I travel around or, across the world, actually, I always have a joke with my wife that wherever I go, I run into people from Gary. I mean, we were in Brazil, ran into people from Gary. Everywhere we go, we run into people from Gary. And part of that is a lot of, and I would say most of those people came out of Gary Roosevelt, because Gary Roosevelt up into, they ran into difficulties with the state takeover. They were putting out people that were succeeding in every field of human endeavor all across the country. So you have a lot of very strong sentiment and attachment to the school, and part of that is because a lot of people that went there see it as more than just a school.
Oh, absolutely. And I do know personally the graduates have come out of there. They're very proud to be attached to Gary Roosevelt. I went to school nearby at East Chicago, Washington. There's a similar attachment just to that name, but Roosevelt is still around. Sometimes you have to separate the emotion from the reality, and the reality is that that building is in major disrepair, and we do know of the problems in terms of academics. So how should the community react to this decision, though?
Well, I mean, this was a decision that really had been deferred for years. I mean, you can make an argument that the trends were clear 20 years ago, and quite frankly, my father went to East Chicago, Washington, and his father went to East Chicago, Washington, and you had a very similar sentiment about East Chicago, Washington among folks from the harbor. So, but at that time, they looked at the trends as like, we must go down to one high school because of decline in enrollment. And quite frankly, that was around the same period of time that East Chicago went down to one high school, that Gary should have been doing the same thing. So it really just comes down to the numbers now. I mean, you can have you can still have a sentimental feelings about the school, but the fact of the matter is the enrollment in the school corporation just no longer supports having two high schools.
Let me ask you this. The decision back in, I believe it was 2012, for the state to take over Gary Roosevelt from the Community School Corporation in Gary, did that move ever really work for the state in terms of trying to turn that school around?
Well, I've been pretty vocal recently that I feel that the state takeover that was initiated originally in 2011 by State Board of Education did not work at Gary Roosevelt. Part of it was the system, the way it was structured. It was just going to be difficult for it to work anyway because you had the state coming in and finding an outside operator to come in and essentially, without much interaction with the school corporation, take over one of its schools. So I think that model was flawed in and of itself. So we've moved away from that type of model now with the State Board of Education. So I think all in all, when I assess Gary Roosevelt's progress under state takeover, it's a disappointment.
What do you think is next for the Gary Community School System? We do know that sometimes the population, the school student population, continues to decline. They're having issues with keeping existing buildings open, existing schools, and there's also this issue of dilapidated buildings that the city wants them to tear down. A lot of issues facing Gary. How can the state help them?
Well, I mean, that remains to be seen what the Distressed Unit Appeals Board is willing to do. I'm not involved with that. But at the same time, the city, along with Mayor Prince and Senator Eddie Melton, are pursuing legislation down in this legislative session to allow some of the debt that the Gary Community School Corporation currently is servicing to be deferred. So that allowed them to direct some of the – right now the school corporation is making about $500,000 in payments a month just to the state in payment of state debt. So they're asking to be able to redirect some of those funds toward fixing the West Side building, which is, almost in as bad a shape as Gary Roosevelt. So we're optimistic that passed through the Senate last week, 49-0, and it's being considered by the Indiana House now. So we're hopeful that, that would be one measure that the state could take to alleviate some of the pressure on Gary Community School Corporation.
When you sit there on the state school board of education, does it feel like the state does have a plan or commitment towards helping urban school districts around the state?
Well, ultimately, the plans have to be developed locally, and that's what we've been spending a lot of time on recently here in Gary, working with the mayor's office as well as State Board of Education and the governor's office in trying to figure out where do we go from here as a whole as it relates to the education environment in Gary. And right now, we're all really focused on the development and building a new state-of-the-art High School in Gary on the campus of Indiana University Northwest and operated in collaboration with either Purdue University or Indiana University Northwest. So that's where we're trying to get to now. Part of that means that we have to start keeping as many kids in the traditional public system as we can. And, I mean, right now, Gary Roosevelt probably had less than 200 kids there. So you have 200 kids over in, you know, in that building that's uninhabitable now. But then you have only probably 50% of the West Side building being utilized for the West Side kids. So really, we have to get all the Gary Community School Corporation high schoolers into one building, and hopefully that's going to be a new state-of-the-art building up on the college campus where they can have some synergies with Ivy Tech and IUN.
That sounds like actually a pretty good plan to be sort of already in that sort of college environment.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they have some options still. We really still don't know, Mike, what ultimately the school corporation will do here. Obviously, they're not going to put money into the new building, but I think one thing we have to point out is that the school is not the building. So Gary Roosevelt still exists as a school, even without it having that facility as its building. As it relates to Department of Education, it's a school number that sort of really matters. So, for instance, they could choose as an option to take that Gary Roosevelt and move it over and make the building at Westside Gary Roosevelt. I mean, that's something that's within their purview to do, and you know, merge that into Westside or even shut down the Westside school number and just make that remaining high school Gary Roosevelt if that's one way they wanted to sort of honor the tradition and legacy by keeping the name and school number of Gary Roosevelt. Now, the problem is their academic numbers are not as strong as the current Westside school, so that would come with some ramifications. The other options they have is we have to keep in mind that the Gary Library system is also a museum authority. So the Gary Library could assume that facility and turn it into a museum. That's one of the ideas that have been floated. And we do have the, you know, municipal boards to be able to take control of that building and keep it alive.
Well, Tony Walker is a member of the Indiana State Board of Education. Mr. Walker, thank you so much for joining us here on Lakeshore Public Radio on Off Mic.
Thank you, Mike. Anytime.
Coming up on Off Mic, Bernie, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, oh my.
Indiana is past halftime in the 2020 legislative session. I'm Matt Pelser. Next time on All In, we'll catch up on what has happened with our State House reporter. We'll also mark Valentine's Day with some love stories. A new Indiana podcast shares the romantic origin stories of married couples, some of whom have been together for more than 60 years. And we'll learn why some species of bats have been drastically declining over the last decade. Join us.
Tune in weekdays at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
The week gets hectic, and you can't always keep up on what's going on. Tune in Saturday afternoons at 3 and Sunday mornings at 9 for Lakeshore Updates with me, Dee Dotson. I'll fill you in on the biggest stories of the week from Northwest Indiana, the State House, and across the rest of the Hoosier State. Join us every weekend here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and podcasts can still be heard on lakeshorepublicradio.org. or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. For Lakeshore Updates, I'm Dee Dotson.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Hope you guys are keeping warm at home because it's very cold outside. And it's Valentine's Day, so that should warm you inside, but as long as you stay inside. Well, Iowa is over. New Hampshire is in the books. Up next is the Nevada caucuses next Saturday, and then off to South Carolina for the Democratic presidential candidates. Indiana doesn't get to vote until May, so we've got a long way to wait. But not as, you know, Illinois is actually a little bit sooner. governor in March 17th. So what are all these candidates doing to drum up support here in these Midwestern states while we have to wait voting? Local supporters are the candidate. These are actually out trying to drum up support for their candidate. And joining me now in studio to talk about the person he's supporting is Joe Kahn, local political campaign official. Joe, welcome to Off Mic.
Hi, Michael.
Well, you're sort of in the camp for Bernie Sanders. What is it, somebody who is helping the Bernie Sanders campaign? What are you doing right now in terms of Midwest Indiana?
Well, they have hit the ground running in Northwest Indiana, unlike 4 years ago. I remember it was at one of the first organizing meetings in Griffith in March, and they had to actually open up a door, a vacant shop on the main drag there in Griffith, because they were going to have it in a coffee shop, and 200 people showed up, and they were just completely flabbergasted how many people were supporting Bernie. But they didn't get going until maybe April with a local office here, and already people are out there working really, really hard for him. So doing call-ins and out of state, and a ton of people from Northwest Indiana drove over to Iowa. I went over to Iowa, spent a day there with a friend, Elaine Kofi, and we knocked on doors in some little town called Lost Nation. So they're already in full battle mode.
You know, Bernie is really not as a stranger to Northwest Indiana as people might think. I remember covering Bernie on some of his visits to the south side of Chicago. He's come to Gary a couple of times. Even before, I mean, people were like saying, this guy Bernie Sanders, this Vermont senator, was going to be running for president. And you're thinking, who? But that's how it's developed. And he just had the day that Pete Buttigieg declared his candidacy for the president last fall, Bernie was in Gary. He was talking to folks.
Right.
So he's not as unfamiliar of the terrain over here as people might think.
I met Bernie Sanders at a Beer with Bernie event at the back of a bar room on the south side of Chicago. He'd come into south side to campaign for Susan Sadlowski Garza, who you know is Eddie Sadlowski's daughter, big steelworker district director. He fit right in. He's got ties to this area pretty tight. He was also campaigning for Chuy Garcia up in Chicago. It took time, and they packed the house there at the old steelworkers local headquarters right on Avenue O across from the memorial, the Republic Steel Massacre Memorial. So, yeah, he's very aware of this area.
You know, Joe, when, you know, you're no different than me or other folks. We're all looking at the same coverage in terms of what happened in Iowa and now the outcome in New Hampshire. But it's gotta help in terms of Bernie Sanders' support that he won the New Hampshire primary as the declared winner, as opposed to say somebody like Joe Biden, who what do his supporters do now that he's had two poor showings out there?
Yeah, it wasn't. It was telling that Joe didn't. He bypassed Nevada and went straight to South Carolina, and that's going to be on the 29th. The population in South Carolina, the majority of the Democratic Party are African Americans in South Carolina, and he thinks that he has a firewall. He's used that word a number of times to halt his slide. But his campaign is in real trouble.
Yeah, I mean, if let's say, for example, you keep racking up these sort of losses, and that's what kind of hurt Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. She kept losing primaries to Bernie Sanders, and you couldn't keep doing that. So let's say Bernie Sanders came out of Iowa or New Hampshire limping, you may not be sitting here so confident.
Oh, no, if he hadn't done well in Iowa and hadn't done well in New Hampshire, he'd be over. It's going to be a war. This is a marathon, not a sprint race, and it's going to be a war not just for, you know, the candidate Sanders. It's going to be a war, I think, for the heart and soul of the party. You know, I am not a Democrat. I am a Green. And so, you know, right now we don't have a candidate yet, and we probably won't want to have one on the ballot here. Our convention is until the summer. So right now I'm working for Bernie because he's in favor of Medicare for All. I founded the Northwest Indiana Medicare for All group, and I think we need that in this country. We have anywhere between 18,000 and 44,000 people here dying for lack of health insurance, and we just have to do this. And Bernie's the most outstanding of several Democrats right now that are supportive of Medicare for All. He actually has the bill. So,
Joe, is there any kind of do you feel any conflict or division knowing that Pete Buttigieg is a Hoosier and is right down the road in South Bend, that you know, by all accounts, he's still, I mean, surprising to a lot of folks that he's up there still as a viable candidate.
Yeah, it's somewhat startling that a mayor of a city the size of South Bend is doing as well as he is doing. But he's a very smart guy, and he's managed to attract a lot of money. There's been a lot of controversy of where that money's coming from, corporations and such. But I don't have any sort of leanings towards Buttigieg at all, because I'm looking at what he's for, and he's for something called Medicare for All Who Want It. It's a warmed over public option, and I spent an hour on Wednesday evening talking to our Medicare for All group. I did research for 2 days on that, and the public option is a fugazi. It's not even a real thing that would work. It's not designed to get everybody covered. At best, it's they hope that it'll be the camel's nose under the tent, that one day we end up with Medicare for All, but it really won't work that way.
All right. When we be back, we're going to have more conversation of the presidential candidates with a supporter of Amy Klobuchar.
What's a chocolatier's favorite day? You guessed it, Valentine's Day. Let's Eat is traveling to Lansing, Illinois, and visiting with Gady's Chocolates and Ice Cream. Gady's Chocolates is coming up to 100 years of serving confectionery delights. In studio, we'll be visited by head chocolatier Chris Rhodes. Join Gady's Chocolates as we learn the inner dippings of the chocolate business. Call in 769-9577 and win a gift card from Gady's Chocolates. Dial in this Friday, Valentine's Day, and join Chris from Gady's Chocolates as we discover the chocolates that are going to be just right for your Valentine's sweetheart. Join Let's Eat with Sharon Jackson and me, Chef Nick, this Friday at 3 o'clock on 89.1 FM, Lakeshore Public Radio, WLPR. Call in and join the fun. Saga Bowl and Yasu!
Hey, just cast a check, and I'm about to blow it all on chocolate. Yeah, I'm about to blow it all on chocolate. Sweet tooth, baby, make that dollar.
Indiana is past halftime in the 2020 legislative session. I'm Matt Pelser. Next time on All In, we'll catch up on what has happened with our State House reporter. We'll also mark Valentine's Day with some love stories. A new Indiana podcast shares the romantic origin stories of married couples, some of whom have been together for more than 60 years. And we'll learn why some species of bats have been drastically declining over the last decade. Join us.
Tune in weekdays at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
The week gets hectic, and you can't always keep up on what's going on. Tune in Saturday afternoons at 3 and Sunday mornings at 9 for Lakeshore Updates with me, Dee Dotson. I'll fill you in on the biggest stories of the week from Northwest Indiana, the State House, and across the rest of the Hoosier State. Join us every weekend here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and podcasts can still be heard on lakeshorepublicradio.org. or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. For Lakeshore Updates, I'm Dee Dotson.
Well, welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Well, we've been talking about some of the local support for the presidential candidates. We've had, you know, the Iowa caucuses happening, and the New Hampshire primaries already behind us now, and we're gearing up now for Nevada and South Carolina. And we're talking to a local supporter of Bernie Sanders. But joining us on the phone right now is Josh Kilroy, who's from Chicago, who's helping the campaign of Amy Klobuchar. Josh, welcome to Off Mic.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, Josh, let me ask you this. We've been hearing a lot about Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. But with some of the how Amy Klobuchar has been performing, she's getting a lot of national play. She's doing better than a lot of people expected. Why are you in her camp?
Sure. And let me just clarify. I have a PAC that is independent of her campaign. I do not coordinate with her or I'm authorized by her in any. So I just want to be clear about that.
Sure.
Sure. So I find that the senator has been a voice for moderation and, you know, a pragmatic voice in the Senate. And I think that in this age of Donald Trump, that is exactly what we need in the White House. I think she's got a long, solid track record on the issues. I think she has the experience. And I think she has the temperament that we need right now.
You know, she is from the Midwest, but we haven't heard too much about her in the Chicagoland area. And this is sort of the first I've heard, you know, of this sort of support. What do you think her support is like in, say, Illinois?
Sure. Well, I should mention, first of all, that she does have ties to Illinois. She graduated from the University of Chicago Law School back in 1985. So she knows our area well here in Illinois and in Northwest Indiana, and so, you know, she understands our values. And, you know, the reason I started this PAC was, you know, I saw her performance in the debate last Friday, and had made exactly the same observation you made. Boy, you know, there's no presence here, and they should do something about that. And then, you know, it occurred to me they're probably focused on South Carolina and Nevada. And, you know, I've worked on many campaigns. So I figured I should do it. And so I put this pack together, and we're going to try to create a presence here in the Midwest over the next few months. We have the primary coming up in Illinois on March 17th. We have a primary in Wisconsin, April 7th. Michigan has a primary March 10th, and Indiana has a primary on May 5th. And historically, the primary in Indiana has never been too much of a factor. But with the fractured field, the Indiana primary could end up being pivotal.
You're right about that. And also the last few presidential primaries have gone on so long that Indiana has been sort of a factor, going all the way back to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton duking it out all the way past May, and them almost being residents of Northwest Indiana that we hear so much.
Right.
How would Amy Klobuchar's message, I mean, really, if you look at the field right now, she really is sort of that moderate voice in the field. But do you think people are going to gravitate to moderation? It seems like they want extremes.
Well, you know, I think the voices further out on the edge tend to be the loudest voices. But, you know, I think most people are looking for a change in not just policies from the current White House, but a change in tone and temperament. And I think that Senator Klobuchar is much better positioned provide that. And, you know, in contrast with some of the other sort of voices that are lumped in with as moderate, Vice President Biden, you know, does not seem to be getting any traction. And I think as time goes on, Pete Buttigieg's support will weaken. Because, I mean, 37 is quite young to be President of the United States, particularly without, you know, more executive experience than the mayor of a mid-sized town.
But let me ask you this, being the mayor of a mid-sized town, just really 90 minutes just east of Chicago, does that work to Pete Buttigieg's advantage over, say, Amy Klobuchar, who we really haven't heard too much in the Chicagoland area over the years?
Well, you know, I mean, she has a track record on the issues. She has plenty of time to get her message out. And the Midwest, because we tend to vote a little later, a lot of the candidates, you know, are still have to make their acquaintance. That's why Bernie has such a big advantage. having gone through this 4 years ago, and having, to his credit, maintained a visible presence in the last 4 years.
But
yes, there's still plenty of time. And we saw that with her surge in New Hampshire. You know, as once people started focusing on the race, most of the late breakers went to Senator Klobuchar.
What do you think Senator Klobuchar's main message is going to be for Midwestern voters in Illinois and Indiana?
Well, that she represents our values. You know, the sort of pragmatic, low-key, common-sense approach that has been synonymous with the Midwest for, you know, for almost 200 years now. That's her approach. And that approach just happens to be what we need in the White House right now.
All right, Josh, we also have an in-studio guest who's who's been working on the campaign for Bernie Sanders, Joe Kahn. Joe, when you see Amy Klobuchar gaining in the polls, she did pretty well in New Hampshire. Could you see her more moderate sort of tone giving Bernie trouble in Midwest states?
No, I don't, honestly. The centrist position of the it's a crowded field, and that's been the problem for Klobuchar and all of them. I mean, there's four of them crowded in there: Biden, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, and now Bloomberg. I just hope they all cheer each other up for the next two or three primaries and caucuses, and Bernie keeps on winning.
Josh, as creating this super PAC for Amy Klobuchar, what does that all entail and how does that operate?
Sure. It's a matter of setting up, just filing some paperwork, but it's really, and creating that independence. But then it's just, ordinary campaign activity. So one of the things that I'm working on right now is to help set up some phone banking and some visibility work in Chicago starting next week, typical campaign stuff, being at the L stops and bus stops with campaign literature, like it's phone banking, knocking on doors if you can.
I have a question. This is Joe. With Bloomberg rising, he's rising pretty fast in the polls, and he's self-financed. Do you think that he might also suck all the money out of the election? Because you guys, you're setting up this PAC for Amy, and Biden, it has been well reported that he's running out of money.
Sure, I'm not concerned about that. I mean, the nice thing about the fact that Bloomberg is self-financing is that precisely that he's not taking money that would otherwise be on the table for other candidates. You know, if he was running an aggressive fundraising operation, I would be more concerned. But I think there's plenty of resources available for candidates like Amy Klobuchar.
You don't think the big money is going to gravitate to the big money? It's not going to attract itself?
I think Bloomberg is a fatally flawed candidate. I think some of his positions, on the stop and frisk, some of the quotes that are now coming up in the news, I think they're deal breakers with Democratic constituencies. So, and there are problems that money can't solve. If he were unknown, the money would be more concerning. But, he has a record of not being very good on labor issues, for one thing, and racial issues of racial equity on another. So, the fact that we're moving into the Midwest, the union vote will be much more of a factor. And I don't think he'll get much traction there at all.
Well, Josh Kilroy is a political strategist out of Chicago. Josh, thank you so much for joining us here on Off Mic and Lakeshore Public Radio.
Can I just plug my Facebook page?
Sure, go ahead.
Midwesterners for Amy Klobuchar. That's where you can follow what we're trying to do.
All right. All right, Josh, thank you so much. I want to thank Joe Kahn for coming in studio also as well and pushing the envelope over there for Bernie Sanders' campaign. So we'll be back with more Off Mic.
Indiana is past halftime in the 2020 legislative session. I'm Matt Pelzer. Next time on All In, we'll catch up on what has happened with our State House reporter. We'll also mark Valentine's Day with some love stories. A new Indiana podcast shares the romantic origin stories of married couples, some of whom have been together for more than 60 years. And we'll learn why some species of bats have been drastically declining over the last decade. Join us.
Tune in weekdays at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
What's a chocolatier's favorite day? You guessed it, Valentine's Day. Let's Eat is traveling to Lansing, Illinois, and visiting with Gady's Chocolates and Ice Cream. Gady's Chocolates is coming up to 100 years of serving confectionery delights. In studio, we'll be visited by head chocolatier Chris Rhodes. Join Gady's Chocolates as we learn the inner dippings of the chocolate business. Call in 769-9577 and win a gift card from Gady's Chocolates. Dial in this Friday, Valentine's Day, and join Chris from Gady's Chocolates as we discover the chocolates that are going to be just right for your Valentine's sweetheart. Join Let's Eat with Sharon Jackson and me, Chef Nick, this Friday at 3 o'clock on 89.1 FM, Lakeshore Public Radio, WLPR. Call in and join the fun. Saga Bowl and Yasu.
Hey, just cast a check and I'm about to blow it all on chocolate.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Well, today is Valentine's Day, sort of the Super Bowl for florists. I stopped by this morning to see how one florist in Merrillville is dealing with all the madness.
So this is just do those two pickups. Well, one of them's not too far, so I'm going
to
do the one that...
Hey, Cindy Lopez, owner of the Merrillville Florist and Tea Room.
Now, Cindy, this is like you recently purchased the this floral shop, and this is your first Valentine's Day. How's it going so far?
Things are going great. We have a whole bunch of happy customers. We have delivery drivers already out and about since early this morning. Orders are all lined up, ready to be picked up, and still have a whole bunch of flowers for anyone who'd like to call and place any orders for today.
So, you know, a couple of weeks ago, it was the Super Bowl. This is the Super Bowl for florists?
Yes, it's definitely. I'm told this is going to be our busiest time of year, our biggest holiday, and it was kind of hard to imagine because Christmas, we just had so much, you know, business in the community and so much support from all of our friends and customers here that it was kind of hard to imagine that this would be busier than that, but it's definitely turned out to be.
I know this Merrillville Florist Shop had been closed for a little bit. When did you take ownership and when did you open?
Sure. So the florist itself has still been open and operating. The tea room was closed for about 17 months. We got in and reopened the tea room in early November and officially took over the business just about a month ago. And we've just had, you know, such a warm welcome and reception from the community being back open. Everyone really missed the tea room for the last year and a half and very excited and happy to come back.
So what are you excited about? I mean, you know, as a guy, you know, I just see flowers and roses, but is it much more than that on Valentine's Day?
Oh, sure. It's so much more, especially for me. So I've always wanted to own a flower shop ever since I was a little girl. And I fell in love with this building from the moment I stepped in. The McCrubbits family, who owned it previously, Ramona, she just did such an amazing job with setting up the flower shop. And we have a gift shop here that has lots of special items, kind of eclectic, unique to the area that you just don't find everywhere. And I think we're the only tea room, really, that's been, you know, open and open for lunch. We're Tuesday through Saturday from 11 to 2:30. And it's just a special place to create memories and to grab a nice cup of tea or a bite to eat.
Would you consider it more geared towards females?
I would say that we do have a handful of men who come in with wives and daughters and come in to grab some tea. They love it just as much as everyone else does. They can, you know, we have chocolate truffles that are here that they love that they pick up on their way out. They grab a gift for, you know, some family members or for their wife or their kids. They definitely love it just as much. So.
So you can accommodate the last minute shopper today, the husbands and the boyfriends who just didn't plan this Valentine's Day.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we have candy cases that are full of some gourmet handmade truffles. We have those in a variety of flavors, and they come boxed really nicely in like a heart-shaped box or a tin. We have some specialty teas that are available. We have some gifts around, and we have lots of flowers that we can still vase up and have it ready to go.
So are roses, the red roses, still the number one ranked flower for today, or are there other colors you would prefer?
Oh, absolutely. We have a great variation, though. So we have some really beautiful red roses. We've got lavender, white, hot pink, light pink. We have orange roses, yellow roses. We have everything that you'd like. So it's great.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay, great. And just want to absolutely, thank Lakeshore Public Radio for the opportunity. Thank you for supporting local businesses. It's opportunities like this that really help our community stick together and support small businesses and grow these opportunities. So thank you.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
The week gets hectic, and you can't always keep up on what's going on. Tune in Saturday afternoons at 3 and Sunday mornings at 9 for Lakeshore Updates with me, Dee Dotson. I'll fill you in on the biggest stories of the week from Northwest Indiana, the State House, and across the rest of the Hoosier State. Join us every weekend here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and podcasts can still be heard on lakeshorepublicradio.org. or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. For Lakeshore Updates, I'm Dee Dotson.
It's not cheap to live in Washington, D.C., especially on a teacher's salary. That's something that can make hiring a challenge.
And that especially affects our ability to recruit and retain teachers of color, many of whom come out of college with much larger college debt.
I'm Molly Wood. How long commutes and expensive housing are affecting D.C. schools. That's next time on Marketplace.
Tune in at 5:30 for Marketplace here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org.
Well, welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Well, it's cold right now in Chicago and in Northwest Indiana. It's supposed to get colder, but the action at the United Center is going to be hot. Why? Well, because it's the NBA All-Star Game. It's NBA All-Star Weekend in Chicago. There's all kind of events leading up to the big game, and a lot of excitement. And joining me to talk about this weekend is veteran Chicago sports journalist Cheryl Ray Stout. Hey, Cheryl, how are you?
I'm good, Michael. Happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, happy Valentine's Day to you. And we'll get into a little bit of Valentine's talk after we wrap up all this NBA talk. But let me, before we get into this big game that's going to be happening in Chicago this weekend, well, it's the first time in a long time that the All-Star Games is playing in Chicago. And I have a funny suspicion that you were at the last one.
The last and only other one. 1988 was when the Bulls, actually, it was Chicago, hosted the All-Star Game at the old Chicago Stadium, which, Michael, was one of the best facilities you could ever imagine if you hadn't been there.
I've been there.
Yeah, so you know, there's something about it that place would come alive. And it wasn't the event it is now. Now it's a spectacle.
Sure.
Back then, it was a couple days, but it was the coronation of Michael Jordan. And it's right. The first day was on Saturday where they had the Legends game and then the slam dunk contest. And they also had it was called the long distance contest. But the slam dunk contest, Michael, was the best. I got to sit stats row right in front of where Michael dunked. So I had the best seat in the house. And to see Michael run the court and fly through the air for his winning dunk was one of the most magical moments I've ever witnessed firsthand.
Yeah, that was a big contest. Some people say that, the Atlanta Hawks superstar Dominique Wilkins actually won that slam dunk contest. I'm biased. Mm-hmm. I love the Bulls. I love Michael Jordan, so I'm going to give the nod to Michael Jordan.
Well, if you look at really technique, Dominique's was more powerful, mm-hmm. and Michael did have one miss in his repertoire. However, for that time, for that moment, it was Michael Jordan. And he had won the year before. That's what people don't remember, that he had actually won the slam dunk contest the year before, but to win it at home.
Yeah, but,
and
Michael had that one dunk where he was like, almost attacking the basket.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think the one where he lifted off from the free throw line.
Right.
Was the one, and there's several pictures where you could see my face, just a little bit of my face in the picture. But in the stadium, that place just went wild.
Sure.
It was crazy. And everyone had their Gatorade 10s, the flash. These sheets of paper that said 10. And that's what you saw the whole arena show that night.
So that was like the original Madhouse on Madison.
Yeah, that's where it actually was created. There was no doubt about it. And the next day with the All-Star Game, where, you know, it was like the way it used to be, it was the Eastern Conference against the Western Conference. And the Eastern Conference won 138 to 133. Michael Jordan scored 40 points in that game. And there's an interesting note about that. He had to play with Isaiah Thomas of Chicago. There were several Chicagoans on these teams. You had Mo Cheeks, you had Isaiah Thomas, you had Mark McGuire. You had these players that had this background of being from Chicago. But in 1985 is when there was the freeze out of the All-Star Game against Michael, and that was engineered by Isaiah Thomas. And here in 1988, they had to play together. And if you want to see some great highlights, there's some great highlights about it. It was a game of transition basketball. You didn't have a lot of three-point shooting, but you had a lot of running and scoring in the post.
Well, now, Cheryl, now coming back to the future here with the current NBA All-Star Game, to me, it doesn't feel the same only because the Bulls don't have a dominant player in that All-Star Game. But I think the league is in a different time because also I teach journalism at locally here at Calumet College of St. Joseph. I was asking one of my students who's very into basketball, do the Bulls have to be popular or have a dominant player for the NBA itself to be popular? And he says, no, it's just such a global game that it really doesn't matter if the Bulls are up there. But to me, there's something taken away. What do you think about that?
It would be great if the Bulls were like they were just a few years ago. And I think it does take a little bit of the Chicago edge out of it. Globally, it doesn't matter because your student's right, because it's a global game now. And that's why back then in 88, it wasn't global yet. It didn't become that. So now it is. And you have a lot of European players, too, on this. The Bulls do have an all-star player. Zach LaVine should be an all-star. I mean, he scores 40 points at will. He minimally scores at least 20, 25 points. And that's a shame that he isn't on that team. He should have been selected mainly because he is a Chicagoan. He is having a great season, but they look at the Bulls' record and they mm-hmm. discount it. And also, there's so much chatter that goes on social media, very negative about the whole organization, that I think that reflects on who gets decided to be in the game. But I think if the Bulls could ever turn things around, they could get back to it. But it does take away back some of that luster. And it's a real shame because, you know, you have this great platform. And Chicago is where basketball is one of it's one of the best sports in all the country. It's right here, is basketball. And to have the Bulls not really sharing that limelight is sad.
Well, Cheryl, could you imagine if social media was around when Michael Jordan first got in the league? The Bulls weren't all that great, and then he had a broken leg. So he probably would have got a lot of negative Twitter and Facebook feedback in those early years.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And if we would have had the cameras we have on our phones now and the stuff that I got to see firsthand at practices.
Yeah, all the selfies.
We used to be able to watch practices.
So what's going to happen this weekend? It's more than just a game. A lot of stuff happening at Navy Pier, not too far away from over here in Northwest Indiana. What's happening?
Well, there's at Wintrust, Navy Pier, and the United Center. Navy Pier has this is for the fans at Navy Pier. It's called Crossover, and there's going to be several players, former players, WNBA players going to be there. And so it's going to be a nice place for people, for families. And I think it's around $20, so it's pretty reasonable compared to what's going to happen at Wintrust with some of the things going on there. Like tonight is the celebrity game at Wintrust. At the United Center is the Rising Stars, which are the top rookies and second-year players in the NBA. Wendell Carter Jr. made the team, but he's got a sore foot, so he won't be playing. He represents the Bulls. And then tomorrow, on Saturday, that's when they're going to have the skills contest, the slam dunk contest, and the three-point shooting contest. And Zach LaVine is in that contest. That's at the United Center. At Wintrust earlier, they do have the NBA players practicing, and they did have seats available. I don't think they have them now. On Sunday night at the United Center, that's the big deal. That's when you're going to have Jennifer Hudson is going to do a performance for Kobe Bryant. They're going to celebrate his life. They're going to have Chance the Rapper doing a halftime. You're going to have the game. It's an interesting style of the game, what they're doing. They're going to play each quarter.
Wow.
And then after each quarter, whoever wins that quarter, either Giannis' team or LeBron's team, they get money for their charity. At the end of three quarters, you take the total scores of what you have, and the first team that reaches 124 gets they win the big amount of money for their charity.
Oh, wow. So it's a little bit different, take
big
on the
difference
Oscar
because
game.
Of Kobe Bryant. 24 is Kobe Bryant's number, and that's what they're trying to align with this.
I see. Well, let me ask you, Cheryl, real quick, switching gears. You know, I was sitting by my phone earlier this week when I knew that it was going to be the first week where pitchers and catchers report to the spring training, and I was waiting for my call from the White Sox. I had my jersey ready. You came by Navy Pier. You saw me at my desk.
I did see it, yes.
But I didn't get the call. But obviously, it is pitcher and catchers reporting now for the Cubs and Sox. What do you know? How excited are you?
I think for the White Sox fans, they have to be very, very excited. I think they know that they have something special. You know, the additions of Dallas Keuchel, plus let's see if Michael Kopech can really get back into the groove after having Tommy John and Dylan Cease. Can he make the next level? You know, and you still have Lucas Giolito. So your pitching staff is really solid. Maybe Ronaldo Lopez will finally, you know, be consistent. You look at their lineup, you know, you've got Grandal, you've got Tim Anderson, the batting champion, you've got Jose Abreu. So there's a lot of positives with them, Eloy Jimenez, and of course Luis Robert's going to be the kid to watch. Then you look at the Cubs, and they still have a solid team, but there's still question marks because you don't know who's going to play second. They didn't sign any top free agents, but they do have core players like Anthony Rizzo and Wilson Contreras. And the big question mark is going to be Chris Bryant. He has yet to report to camp. That will happen on Monday. But there's still question marks whether he'd be traded or not. And, of course, you've got a brand-new manager who's never managed before. And with the stories that we've heard about the differences between Joe Maddon and the front office, I think there's going to be a lot of situations where the front office is going to dictate what David Ross does as a manager.
Yeah, and David Ross, right off the bat, he does have somewhat of a controversy in his hands. And how does he get Chris Bryant to forget about this arbitration loss and just concentrate on baseball?
Well, and let me tell you, I do know Chris Bryant. You know, there are players that you really I've gotten to know him. He's not that type of guy. He will not allow that to infringe on what he does as a player. And I think, because of his character, because of his reputation, I don't think that's going to be a problem. I think everyone thinks it's going to be a problem, but I think he's one of those players that you always enjoy talking to, and you rarely see him get angry. You can see him get a little, but you never see him get angry like I've seen other players. I think he knows it's a business, and he knows that he's got to perform. And if he gets traded, it's going to happen. You know, there's nothing he could do about it. So I think for David Ross, he's fortunate that it's a type of character player that he could deal with. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of chats with Chris Bryant by the front office to make sure, to assure that. But I don't think there's going to be real big issues about it. I think it's worrying me more every time he sees reporters, and there's always new reporters that come around in spring training, he's going to be asked the same question over and over again.
Cheryl, real quick, what does a Cheryl Ray style do for Valentine's Day?
I'm going to the Rising Stars game tonight. Oh. We celebrated last night. I made a turkey dinner last night for my husband.
Wait a minute. You're getting your holidays mixed up. That's Thanksgiving.
Well, you know what? It's a nice dinner. This is also, see, this is a big weekend for us because it's our anniversary on Sunday and my birthday on Monday. So we don't know when we're going to celebrate all three.
I see. All right. Well, you can hear all of Cheryl Reistout's reporting on WBEZ in Chicago. And that's all the time we have for Lakeshore Public Radio on Off Mic. I'd like to thank the staff, the fabulous D. Dotson, El Hombre, Jose Rodriguez, and El Guapo, Tom Maloney. For me, Michael Puente, for Off Mic, have a great Valentine's Day. Stay warm. Get those flowers and candies. And dudes, you still got time to go out there and do the right thing. Get you some flowers. All right. Have a nice weekend.